Hi guys, welcome back from spring break. Hopefully you had a relaxing break or fun, if not relaxing. I spent mine playing video games, so I'm not gonna talk about that. But today we're gonna talk about the exam and its solutions. So here's our agenda, exam one solutions. And then for those of you watching elsewhere, I'd like to note that there were sort of two versions of the exam, i.e. some questions. Like here, the PowerPoint will cover all the questions, but some of you may find a few of them unfamiliar. And then, you know, if there were two different versions, the point values may differ a bit. So just a note, so that you don't see something that I cover and you're like, what, I didn't see this question? But yep. So why don't we jump into the exam? And here's page one, or the first half or third of page one. Question one, which of the following is the correct order of prefixes from largest to smallest? Hopefully this one wasn't too hard for you guys. If you would recall that the order kind of goes like that. I've written it in reverse order. And if you sort of look at that or remember that, you can sort of see that B, C, and D are out of order. Like giga is not smaller than kilo for B. And kilo is not bigger than mega for C, and D similarly. So the answer was A! Yes. Okay, so for number two, which of the following is equivalent to 8 megabits? Note this is bits and not bytes. It's kind of weird, but if you recall that 8 bits equals 1 byte, we can cross off A. Right, because 8 bits, not 8 megabits, is 1 byte. And you can sort of think about, one way to think about this would be sort of abstractly how you think of, like, if you multiply 8 bits by some constant, you'll get 8 megabits. And if you multiply 1 byte by the same constant, you'd get 1 megabyte. So if you think about it like that, the answer might jump out at you. Or you can also do it mathematically. So computers sort of, well, the increments in computer language, I guess, is in 1024. So you can sort of convert between bits and bytes and megabits and megabytes. So say you have 1 megabit, that is 1024 kilobits. 1 kilobit is 1024 bits. So that means 1 megabit is actually that big number of bits. It's 1 million... 48,576 bits. And if you divide it by 8, because there are 8 bits in a byte, you get that many bytes over there, 131,072 bytes. And then if you want to go if you want to go up and see how many megabytes that is, you'd have to do that math conversion there. And then you end up with 0.125 megabytes is 1 megabit. And since you have 8 megabits, you multiply it by 8, and you get 1 megabyte. So yay, math! If if you didn't quite catch the little constant trick, or you know the little trick there, you could have done the math and figured out that way. And moving on to question three, which is for the fastest wireless network your computers and wireless routers should support. So this seems to me sort of like one of those you should know or should have studied. And here's the information from where you can like find it. It was in lecture 4, around 7246 in the video. And I think in it, Dan mentions the speeds for A, B, G, and N. And there they are on screen. So it was sort of one of those, you know it, or you guess, hopefully, correctly. But, yep, questions on this? Okay, moving on. Bottom part of page one, I think. So, question four, your computer can automatically be assigned an IP address through, oh no, and then a whole bunch of acronyms and what? Well, if you recall, DNS is domain name system. And then the rest of these are as follows. if you sort of vaguely remember, you know, their names, not that I would recommend like memorizing everything, but if you vaguely remember them, you might sort of be able to reason out, okay, which one of these might give me an IP address automatically. So domain name, you know, that doesn't really, sort of associated with IP addresses, but not directly. And then dynamic host, ooh, dynamic, automatic, maybe. And then TCP IP, oh, hey, IP addresses, right? Well, turns out the right answer is B. And you can see it in lecture 3 at 6750 in the video of lecture 3-ish. And yeah, DHCP is the one that automatically gives your computer all the information it needs to sort of connect to the internet. So moving on to 5, which is CPUs these days typically come in speeds in the range of, and then you get some standards of measurements, I guess. And here's our little hint. CPUs execute instructions measured on how fast they can do so, and gigahertz is cycles per second. Or if you just sort of remember any one of us talking about the speeds of our CPU being 2 point something gigahertz, that would lead you to your answer there. And then moving on to 6. Question is, one of the easiest ways to increase the performance of your computer and allow you to run more programs at once, which I think is awesome, would be to upgrade the blank. Let's see if we get a little hint here. So, if you would recall that running programs require them to be loaded into memory first before they can actually be run or whatever, and if you'll also remember that CPUs and GPUs only execute instructions, GPUs is more for like graphics and stuff, graphics rendering. So if you sort of recall this, hopefully you can remember or tease out that the answer is A if you didn't, you know it to begin with. Yay, questions on this? Hopefully you guys are doing well so far, or did well so far, I guess. So moving on to page 2 of the local version of the exam. Which of the following terms can be a synonym for a motherboard? Fatherboard? Daughterboard? CPU? Logic board? Well, hopefully you can rule out CPU, because that's the processor that like does all the instructions. You can maybe think about like if there's a motherboard, like daughterboard seems to be an extension of mother, right? Mother, daughter, so it might not be the same. Fatherboard sounds like it would be the opposite, but and then hopefully from that you might be able to guess that it's the logic board if you didn't quite remember. That can be found in lecture 2, around 50:41 in the video. So hopefully, I'm just sort of trying to walk you through how I would do this if I wasn't quite sure how to, you know, which one's the right answer, or like, how do I guess, or like, you know, what? So if, you know, hopefully maybe this will help for next exam or in the future with other exams or things of the like. So yeah, yay, logic board! So moving on to 8, a typical SSD, solid state drive I think it is, might have a capacity of ? So if you'll recall, somewhere back in the depths of your memory, hopefully, that an SSD is an HDD alternative. So it's where HDD we have the little platters with the moving heads. SSD, you just have, you don't have the platter, you don't have the moving heads, you just have sort of the memory. It's like the memory in your flash drives. So it's all electrical, it's super fast, but as it's super fast, it's kind of expensive as well. So it's costly per unit. And if you sort of maybe recall from a computer, or from my computer, from Dan or David's computer, HD capacity is about several hundred gigabytes. Mine's about 300. So I just put that up there because I was like, oh, cool, I'll just check in on mine. But so if you sort of recall all that, okay, I think we're going to X stuff out here. You might be able to tease out that terabytes, which is a lot more than gigabytes, would not be the answer because terabytes are a lot. And if HDD doesn't sort of support that, then you know, that might not be the right answer. So 8 gigabytes are 80 gigabytes. That's kind of hard, but the answer is 80. I guess, not quite sure. I guess when it comes to this, you might guess. Or also sort of recall that when there's only one number, like as opposed to like two numbers, like two digits, when there's only one digit, it's more the magnitude of, say, RAM. So like, wait. So like my computer has like 3 gigabytes of RAM. I guess maybe if it got SSD, it might be 30 gigabytes of SSD, I'm not quite sure. But I guess it's one way you can sort of think about it in magnitudes. HDD has like 3 digits. RAM has 1 digit. And then SSD, 2 digits, yay. I guess it's sort of how you can tease out the answer. Yes, question?
Was that, do you have the time in the lecture date that
was? I'm pretty sure this is lecture 2, where David was sort of shopping for, wait, do I have that? No, I don't. Huh. Well, I might have it on another slide because I thought I had it. But yeah, it's on lecture 2 where David's sort of shopping around for computers. And then he sort of mentions SSD and how much more expensive it is, but how much better it is or how worse it is. So it's definitely in lecture 2. But I think I might have it later on for another question. So yay, question 9. I think. Or next question. How many bits do you minimally need to represent the number 4 in binary? How could we solve this one? Well, I guess you could convert 4 into binary, which would be 100 or 100, not to be confused with decimal. And then, well, you sort of have your answer. If you need a 1 and a 0 and a 0, each of those being bits, then you would need 3 bits. So yeah, that's just a bit of binary knowledge, I guess, if you want to call it that. Or binary conversion, not quite sure what you want to call it. Yay! Questions on this? No? We're all binary masters, maybe? I know I'm not, but maybe you guys are. Cool. So moving on. Our next question is the sort of memory someone is referring to when they describe their computer as having 4 gigabytes of memory, whatever memory it is, question mark. This sort of ties back into what I was saying before about magnitudes of memory and stuff. If you'd recall that HDD is about, you know, triple digits, and RAM is about single digits, then, you know, you would sort of see the correlation that, oh, hey, 4 gigabytes is probably RAM. Although my computer only has 3. Guess I should be jealous here. I don't know. It's 3 years old. Eh. Cool. And then that concludes our multiple choice section. Yeah. Which, awesome. Which leads us to true or false. On probably page 3, depending on which version you have. But I've just put it on the same slide. Next question, or first true or false. You are doing well on this test so far. You know what we're going to answer? Yes. Yes. Happy face or winky face. So moving on, 12. MediaWiki is blogging software. True, false? Is it true? Is it false? What do you guys say? No? Shaking heads? Okay. Well, that is correct. It's not blogging software, as hopefully you've seen from your homework. We have the wiki and we have the blog, and they're not the same at all, really. So false. It's actually, if you go to their like website, their documentation, they say it's open source wiki software. And I guess by wiki, they mean the sort of thing you'd see on Wikipedia, the sort of encyclopedia type where you can have different users edit certain articles that stay around, as opposed to blogging where you just sort of, in my opinion, it's more like a journal reflecting on news and current events and stuff like that. So yay, false. MediaWiki is not blogging software. And next one is NAT is a technology that allows multiple computers on a private network to share one external IP address. So this just goes back to, I think, Dan's lecture 4, where he talks more about the whole IPv4, oh no, we're running out of addresses. But it's not quite true that every single computer or machine that connects to the internet has one public IP address. So that's where you can find it, and the answer is true. And, yep. Questions on this? Hopefully it's jogging your memory that has already remembered this stuff the first time you took the exam, maybe. Okay, well, if there are any questions, let's go on to what I have listed as 14. L1 cache is faster than L2 cache? True, false? If you'll remember, I think the images David drew on the board, and if you looked at section slides, you might have seen the little animation. You'll see that L1 was closer to the CPU, or closer. It's actually usually on the CPU, but closer compared to L2. And you might remember David saying something like, the closer it is to the less distance you have between two parts that need to convey information, the faster it is. So yes, it is true. L1 cache is faster than L2. Yes, and both of those are faster than RAM and the hard disk. Mostly because of distance, but yay. Moving on, that number there, 150, 256, 32, 107, is a valid IP address? Maybe, no, yes, no. Consensus is no, why? Well, if you'll recall, each of those octets, or each of those cluster of numbers separated by dots, is only from 0 to 255. Yay, so false. If only that one number there was different, then it'd be a different story. But okay, moving on. Your home computer, if properly configured, could act as a web server on the internet. True? False? Yay, nodding. It is true. Web servers are just pretty much, I guess if you want to think about them, or you can look up a picture on Google Images, they're kind of like the towers of your PCs, just like in racks, sitting in racks in data centers somewhere. But if you have a laptop or a computer sitting around, you could configure it to serve things if you wanted to. So next question. In binary math, 10 plus 11 is 101. What? Well, remember the binary. Here I would suggest what I would do is just convert, 10 into decimal and 11 into decimal and then 101 to decimal. Okay, so what's 10 in binary? Hopefully you guys said 2. Yes, 2, yes. I saw those hands in the air. What's 11? 3, yes. And then 101, slightly more difficult, I guess, quote unquote. Yay, 5, yes. So this in decimal is actually 2 plus 3 equals 5, question mark? Well, that appears to be true, at least for us as we know it, or as I know math, I hope. Yay! Is that the end of our true false? Okay, so what I have is page 4, the email. It looks like this, kind of daunting in my opinion. I think this question was snuck in here to sort of have you guys analyze something that looked kind of foreign, sort of have you guys be in an environment where things didn't really look familiar and see how you would deal and sort of sort things out. But even though it looks daunting, we can do this. We can do this. I'll point out the parts that you might have wanted to look at when answering these questions on screen. So, yay! Let's move on to the questions. What I have is question 18. What is the subject line of this email? And also, since that's probably a softie, let's pair it with question 19, as I have up there. From what device did Dan send this email? So I've sort of taken the bottom part of the that daunting email you saw before, just so we can see everything in larger or more detail, I guess. So subject, what is that? That's kind of easy. You have this header that just says subject. RE, OMG, no servers died. Awesome. And then our second question, well, it looks like there it sort of tells you X mailer. You might not know what X mailer is or what that X is doing in front of mailer, but I'm sure you could sort of think about it, figure it out that, iPhone mail, right? like mailer, iPhone, mails, I guess. So yay, hopefully that wasn't too hard. And then, so there are answers. OMG, no servers died, and iPhone, yes. Moving on to what I have is question 20. According to the received lines, I'll show you that in a bit, in the headers above, i.e. next slide or slide before, when did Dan send the email, and what time did David receive the message in his inbox? So this proved to be pretty tricky for a lot of us. Here's the email again with sort of Dan's message cut out, and I think the rest of it is here. So if you sort of start from down here where Dan, where you can sort of see, you can sort of see here where it says user authenticated as and then his sort of his email, his user ID here. You can sort of guess that the headers, the more recent headers are at the top. And then as you can see at the very top, you see it's delivered to like David Mailin or Mailin at post. Down here, it starts out at mit.edu. So if you sort of wade through all this, you can find like the very first, I don't want to call it timestamp, but very sort of first instance of time mentioned when it gets sent off. And that's right here, Thursday, 13th January, 2015:54 EST. And then as I said before, the more recent stuff is more recent, quote unquote, is at the top. So if we can find the most, quote unquote, recent time stamp, if you want to call it that, up there, it's right there, 17:18:23 Pacific Standard Time. I guess that could have been sort of hard since there's so many like times in here and so much information that you had to like sort of wade through and pick. But that should be our answer. And as a check, if you were kind of wary, like maybe you picked out the two times and dates, but then you were like, oh no, which one's sent and which one's received? Here's a little check you can do, or here's a little check I guess I would do. Just sort of convert both of them into the same time zone, and you'll see, you know, the earlier one, 8:15, should be sent because you can't receive something before you sent it unless something weird is going on. But that's just a little check there in case, you know, you weren't sure which one was sent and which one was received. So if you didn't know that the more recent headers were like up top, then you know, this check could have been useful. Cool. That was kind of tricky. Questions on this? Seems like a lot of sort of sorting through things that you haven't seen and picking them out. But you guys can do it. I believe in you. Okay, if there aren't any questions, let's move on to the next question, which states, even though it's not explicitly stated anywhere in the email or its headers, name two pieces of information that we could use to figure out, you know, kind of where Dan was when he sent this note. Okay, how do we do this? Put on our detective caps, and let's take another look at that daunting email thing. I guess in my opinion, the easiest, or the thing that jumps out the most would be, you know, Dan's email. He sort of, by the context of his email, you can sort of guess what time zone he's talking about, or what time zone he's not in, or what time zone he is in. So that's one thing, context of the email. Like, if I sent you an email saying, hey, I'm in San Diego now, and it's awesome, then you know I'm in San Diego. But I guess it's more obscure here. The second thing, sort of apparent, kind of, I hope, would be the date that that Dan's email client sort of put on there. So there you have the date and time in sort of the time zone plus 0800. And then another piece would be Dan's IP address. Like all the other IP addresses that you see, that's the IP addresses of like MIT's servers and you know other servers that's not like Dan's. This is when Dan sends his note, like this is sort of the IP address of his machine. So that can sort of, you can use that to sort of pinpoint where his machine was at that time and go from there. If you picked like the other IP addresses, that's not quite right because you would just get the IP address of that machine. That's not Dan's. Questions? Yes.
How do you know
that stands? So the question was, how do you know it's that IP address that you choose? How do you know that it's that one is where, like, where Dan's machine is? Well, if you recall how I said that the more quote unquote recent information is up top, that might sort of lead you to look at, oh no, where's my mouse? Look at this last received header here, and then it says received from. Here's a private IP address, and here's his public. I just know that because the prefix 192 point blah, blah, blah is usually private. And then here it says user authenticated as, and then there's Dan's ID, I guess. So going from there, how it mentions user authenticated as blank, and there's his IP, that's how I would sort of guess that that's his IP and not some server sitting in MIT somewhere. So yes, that was a tricky one. But you guys can do it. Just stay calm. Think about it, and then you can do it. Yay! So, I've listed three here, just to expand on, I guess, give you more options, or give you more answers, I guess. But just two would have been fine. Yay! Okay, so we're not done with the email just yet. Here's a longer question. You can read it, or you can look at your test, or to my knowledge, this is asking. Hey, okay. So to my knowledge, this is asking. Okay, so for all you Gmail users, you'll notice that sometimes the threads collapse. So like say you send an email, someone replies to your email, and then you send another email, or you reply to that email, and then there's a whole chain of replies. If you use Gmail, or I think other email clients might also support it if you enable it, you'll notice that all the threads like sort of collapse under one heading, I guess. So that when you click on it, you can expand it. So this question asks, how do you think the email client does that? How does it know which reply corresponds to which original email, and how does it pretty much link replies and the original so that it can collapse things like that? That's pretty much what it asks. And let's go back and look at this. So here we're looking for some sort of identification, something to link or connect emails from their replies. If you sort of search through all this stuff, you might notice, maybe the subject, right? Like if you send an email with the subject, someone replies, it sticks on the RE thing with the subject. Maybe that's the answer. Well, yeah, I guess that's one way the email clients, the people who wrote them, could have done it. But what if two messages have the same subject? Or what if, like, I get a whole bunch of email messages that don't have any subject, and Gmail certainly does not clump all those together. So that's not quite the answer. But if you sort of look through this some more, you might think, oh, cool, there's this in reply to. That sounds like it implies that, this was in reply to something. That sort of looks like some sort of identifiable long string of letters and numbers. That might be an ID of sorts. And indeed, this is what the Gmail client can use to link messages. It uses this with this message ID thing up here. You can sort of see they're kind of in the same format-ish. They have a long string of numbers and letters followed by the domain. With this in reply to and this message ID, your Gmail client can sort of look through your inbox and see if any of these match up, and if they do, I'm just going to like compile them into one thread. So yay, it knows precisely what is what, and it takes out that guesswork of, oh, these have the same subject, but are they really the same, or do they just have the same subject as a coincidence? So yay, that's how that happens. Isn't that cool? Question?
Just for clarity, so you would need both the in reply to and the message ID, or either one of those?
I think when it was graded, either one would be okay because it sort of implied the other. Okay. Like if you had, yay. Cool. So hopefully that wasn't too painful. But, you know, if in reply to matches another email's message ID, the email client can figure out precisely that that was a reply to that and not like, oh, this subject looks kind of similar. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So that was the answer there. Daunting, maybe, but I think if you just stay calm and you try to reason through all this stuff, it shouldn't be too terribly hard. Because I believe in you! Yes, you guys can do it. You can do this. Okay, so last question of the email question. What do the XSPAM, flag, score, level, and status headers imply about when and where a message is detected as spam? So this one, I think, was pretty hard. Let's go back here. Let's check out our spam tags, or that's what I'm going to call them, spam headers, maybe. And for me, I would start thinking about, okay, these were added sort of here, or they appear here. We notice them here. When were they added? What does that mean? So going down one, because if we've already seen it, that means they've already been added by something before. So the received header from below says, from blah, 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 harvard.edu. Okay, so you received it from a server, and then probably search around some more, and then the one right below that is from MIT. So I might sort of think, so after it's received at Harvard, it already has these flags, and to get to Harvard, it went from MIT server. So I would sort of guess that, maybe it's when they changed servers, like when it's getting passed between servers that the XSPAM headers were tacked on there. So in my opinion, that was a bit harder than the other question, but the key here was like, the servers do it. They don't just randomly, magically, wah. Nope, servers. Cool. Hopefully there weren't questions on that. No? Okay. So, page 6. Getting a web page. How are we doing on time? Oh, no. Okay. So, this was the write a paragraph? Yep. Use these terms in a paragraph or two and sort of explain how you would get your laptop or your machine onto the internet and visit our course website. Pretty much question, explain that process. How does it work? Here are some terms you should probably use. Here's a quickie that I wrote up. You guys probably wrote more than I did, or maybe less, but here's sort of the story as I see it. So you're sitting in the coffee shop, you try to connect to the Wi-Fi, your machine's like, hey, I want to get on the internet. So that dynamic protocol that gives you, your IP and DNS list, DHCP gives you all that stuff. Yay! Now you can get on the internet. You type in a URL, like www. Let's do cnn.com. And then once you type it in, its IP address gets looked up using the DNS, and then your request sort of gets sent there using this HTTP protocol. And with this protocol, you pretty much sort of states that data is sent in packets, and then it's going to hop from router to router until it gets to your target, server. And then there are these things called ports, and different ports are used to send or receive data depending on the service. So I think Dan talked about how there's the email service. Yeah, so different ports serve you different services, I guess. And then after that, the server sends you back data or information, web pages, in the form of HTML for your browser to display. So that's sort of the condensed version of this story. Okay, page 7, hardware. Gave you a neat little picture that looks like this. I thought it was neat. Hopefully you guys thought it was neat. It's kind of weird. Your bird's eye view down at this board that's like flat on the table, or flat on your page, I guess. So let's start with the easiest thing. What's this square-looking thing? Yes! It's CPU. Like, if you didn't remember that, hopefully you sort of remembered it was a square thing and it sits sort of in the middle of your board. Like, CPU, that's the square thing we always show, I guess. So let's move down to these little slots. I wonder what could go in there. Well, hopefully you'll remember, or something will trigger your memory that you stick things that look like these in there, and then hopefully you'll remember that these are RAM, yay! And in case you didn't remember that, or you didn't know what RAM looked like, you could also sort of look at what, I guess, the people who made the board labeled these as. They're labeled as DIMM, and if you sort of recall, David talked about this in, I think, lecture 2, where he said that DIMM was sort of a type of RAM, I think. But, yes. So, let's go down here, this IDE2 thing, or just IDE, because I guess the number is the slot number. It doesn't really do anything for the name, I guess. So IDE, what the heck is that? Well, it's another one of those, hopefully you watched lecture 2 really closely. It's, David mentions it in lecture 2, around 40, 48. He says it's mostly for the older hard drives and the little floppy disk drive animation or film that we watched. Might have also mentioned that it goes in here. So that was one of the tougher ones, in my opinion. But if you know your lecture too, hopefully it wasn't too hard. And then moving on to this SATA thing here, also with the same lecture, pretty much the same time as well, lecture 2, 40, 48. David mentions how, you know, IDE was the old stuff, the newer stuff, SATA for the newer hard drives. We'll probably go there. That's how you can sort of guess that, oh, SATA. What do I remember about SATA? I think David said something about hard drives. So then, you know, then hopefully you put that down and like, yeah, you know, I'm going to get this right. Cool. So moving up, going up around, we go on to these other slots. These long, longish slots that maybe you could confuse for like RAM slots. But if you'll notice, they say PCI. And in that same lecture, David mentions that PCI are peripheral component interconnect. So if you just remember that, or if you just remember some of those words, maybe you'll be able to sort of tease out an answer like peripherals, okay. So some sort of peripherals connect here. They look like you can slot cards in them or something like that. They're long. Maybe you can slot cards in them. So maybe that might lead you to think expansion cards. There's the time for that in lecture 2 if you want it. This is where David sort of talks about how he used one of his to stick in like a TV tuner, I think, when he wanted to, you know, mess with some tech there. I think he tells a story about that. But yes, that's the PCI slot. And yay, here's one of my favorite blocks, I guess, on the picture, because it's not really a slot. USB port! That pretty much like gives you the answer, I hope. So USB, love the little connector. What comes to mind for me would be flash drives, like USB flash drives, thumb drives, whatever you want to call them. Stick them in, you have some memory that you can stick stuff on there. Also USB peripherals like mice, like the one I'm using. This is USB right here. If I unplug it, I won't be able to do cool stuff, so I can't show you it. But keyboards, other things that use USBs, pretty much a lot of things. So yay, that should be our hardware page. Hopefully you guys did all right. Yay. So moving on, short answer. My 26 says, besides circumventing a firewall, why would you want to use VPN? Why would you want to do that? Well, if you recall at the end of one of my sections, anonymity, no one, quote unquote, knows who you are, kind of. Or say you have a network where certain resources is only accessible on that network. Say, like Harvard's network, you can access, there are certain things you can only access on Harvard's network, and you can't access like at home, on your home internet or whatever. So if you use a VPN, it can seem like you're on, you know, you're at Harvard or on the Harvard network, and then you can use those resources. So yay! Awesome. Questions? Well, questions on that or before or No questions? Okay, next question. What happens if two computers on the internet have the same IP address? Oh no! Well, what happens if two people on your block have the same address? Oh no! Where does the mail go? It's sort of the same here. You have this IP conflict and then routing, which is sort of like delivering mail, delivering data, sending data. You have errors in that. Because if you have the same IP address, how do you tell one machine from the next? You really can't, so you probably won't receive all your data, or you might receive someone else's data, which, you know, would be bad. But, yep. Hopefully that one wasn't too hard. Our next question is, what is a TLD? TLD. Top level domain. So it's the highest level domain. Some examples are like .com, .edu, and the country domains like .uk, .tv, I think was one. And then I guess that was more of a like, do you know this? Sort of question. And then next question. Oh, oops. Gave you the answer. Why hard drives can be ruined by falls or other physical shocks. Don't try this at home. I was tempted, but I sort of like my laptop. We have this tenuous friendship going on here. So if you drop it too much or you subject it to physical shocks, the read-write head can hit the platter and sort of mess up the arrangement of the magnetic particles, or it can, you know, pretty much do really bad stuff that destroys your data. So I found this image here. I guess the resolution's kind of low, but you can see all these holes and things on the platter. You can probably guess that data's not going there anymore and can't be read off of there. So that's bad. That's why you shouldn't be, I guess, dropping your laptops and all that sort of stuff. Okay, so next question. Why has there been a push towards IPv6 in recent years? If you recall, IPv4 is what we currently have. It seems to me that Dan and like the whole bunch of us have been talking about like, oh no, we're running out of IP addresses using IPv4. So that's pretty much the answer. We're running out of, you know, IP address space. And with IPv6, it's a different sort of type of addressing. Like they don't use the four octets that IPv4 does. They use something like bigger, larger. So you would be able to get a lot more addresses out of that. So yes. Hopefully that question wasn't too hard, but don't worry, we're almost done, almost there. Okay, so let's continue with our short answer. What is virtual memory? Well, I guess it's one of those where you just gotta know it. It's a portion of the hard disk drive that data is carted off to when RAM is low. So if you're running a whole bunch of programs and then you need more RAM to load another program, you know, you're obviously not on all your programs at all the same time. Like I might have Photoshop open, but then I might be, I don't know, browsing the internet and not using Photoshop for a while. It might cart that Photoshop data off into HDD because I'm not actively using it. So, yep, that's what virtual memory is. I guess I should have emphasized that in section more, but oops. Okay, next one. This one I did emphasize, I think, it was emphasized. Latency and bandwidth. We tended to call bandwidth more like download speed, but hopefully you can sort of guess that since it was paired with latency, you know, maybe they were one and the same. So latency, hopefully as you know, is the delay between a request and receiving like a response. Bandwidth is the speed of data transfer. So if you want, you can sort of think back to our little hose analogy, which I won't reiterate, but it's on the review slides, I think. If you want to remember, I guess. So, moving on. Wow, short on time. What is misleading about that domain right there? Well, it's that it looks similar to the course's website, but it uses the subdomains of badguy.com. So, computerscience1.net is a subdomain here of badguy.com. So, yeah, that's sort of like, scamming websites you might sort of see things to look out for. Next question, how might web servers know what kind of computers have been accessing their websites? So the answer's already there for you. With the HTTP protocol, you send headers that reveal certain things like they list it as user agent, which pretty much tells tells you the type of computer. So you can sort of find an example there on lecture 4, 49, 29. You can find like a real life example. And then question 35, why is it unreliable to compare processor speeds from, you know, say Intel versus AMD? This one is kind of a bit tricky. I think David mentions it at the end of lecture 2 when he's showing you, he's buying, quote unquote, a new computer and he sees two different processors and he sort of tells you that you can't quite compare them if they're made by different companies. So here's an answer. CPUs are clocked by how fast they do one task or certain tasks, but different processors might take different instructions, go about different ways of doing that same task. So you can't really weigh them against each other in case, I don't know, maybe AMD takes four instructions to do this one task, which takes longer, or maybe less than an Intel processor that does the same task in, I don't know, two instructions. So you can't quite compare them that way. You should probably only compare them within the same like company or type. So, extra credit, yay, the fun part. Well, the fun part, in my opinion. Maybe you guys didn't think it was so fun. But 36, write a new question. Well, this was possibly a freebie. I kind of gave you guys some sample questions that weren't on the test in the review session. Here's one of them. There's the question, and there's the answer. Yay! So hopefully that wasn't too hard. I'm sure you guys could come up with tons of cool questions and correct answers. But moving on to 37, this one asks about, you can read it if you want, it asks about why a 1 terabyte hard drive is, you know, advertises having 1 terabyte, but when you plug it in, it only has like 931 gigabytes of usable space. Explain this. Maybe use math. Show why this happens. So I'm just going to tell you guys. Or you guys can tell me, but manufacturers, or normal people, I guess, use base 10, computers use base 2. 1 TB, quote unquote, in decimal would be, you know, 1,000 raised to the 4 bytes, which is that big long number there. And then 1 TB in binary, or in computer terms, I guess you want to call it, would be 1024, because that's sort of the measurement chunk, if you want to think about it like that, raised to the 4, which is that number there. And then how do you know it's like 1024 raised to 4 or 1,000 raised to the 4? Well, if you sort of remember your conversions, for decimal, it's 1,000 because conversion is, you know, like 1 kilo anything is 1,000 times the base. And then for computers, it's 1024 times the base. So that's just some conversions, the raised to the 4. And then next question you want to ask yourself is how many computer, quote unquote, TBs are in the manufacturer's TB, you know, in sort of a form of fraction. So you just put decimal TB over binary TB and you get, it's actually 0.909. That's the fraction of a terabyte you actually get. And then you multiply it by 1024 to get that number in gigabytes. Because the question asks for you to explain why you only get 931 gigabytes, not like 0.91 terabytes. So that's how you would go about doing that. Pretty tricky in my opinion. But if you had the time and you know, you just sat there and you reasoned it out, I believe that you can do it. Questions on this? Maybe it sort of ties into the joke of this computer scientist going to a butcher's shop and complaining that he didn't get his kilo of meat. Maybe ring any bells? I don't know. Anyway, let's move on to the last one. Yeah, binary. I love this stuff. So there's our cool ASCII table. We didn't give it to you guys, but hopefully you took someone's advice to memorize big A and little a, which is 65 and 97 respectively. If you memorize that, you can use a bit of math to sort of figure out the offset from those and figure out what letters they were. So, So here's our first chunk. Our first byte, I guess, if you want to call it that. I've made the neat table for you. All you need to do is where there's a 1 in the column, just add that number. Like, so here you see there's a 1 in the 64th column and a 1 in the 4's column and a 1 in the 2's column. You just need to add 64 plus 4 plus 2. So that's sort of easy way of doing binary into decimal. So I did the addition for you. 70, what is that? F. Of course, you might have to do a bit more math, like, okay, I know big A is 65, 70 is 5 away from big A. What's 5 letters away from big A? Big F. So since you didn't have the ASCII table, but I'm just doing this for clarity, and I think it would be more fun to see this. So our next byte, if you add up the column headings that have ones under them, get 73. And then you figure out the offset of that from 65, you get I. So here's a little word down here. I wonder what FI could mean. What? This is like Wheel of Fortune or something. So, next one. Pretty much repeat the procedure, and you find that you get an N. The next one, hey, that looks awfully familiar. It's 73 again. That's I, right? We already figured that one out before, but here it is again. So F-I-N-I, Finnish? No, that has double N's. What could this word be? So you pretty much repeat the procedure with a lot of math, and hopefully this nifty table, the table with the column headers to help you out. Finnish, I think we can guess it now. 69 is E, and then D, exclamation point. Yay, finished. Finished the test, and I suppose we're finished here. So feel free to send us any comments, questions, concerns, cool stories. If you wanted to read up on some news, what, AT&T bought T-Mobile? What? This concerns me because I have T-Mobile. So I don't know what this means yet, but you can read an editorial about why this is bad for the consumer if you click that link. And also, for fun, Super Mario! Someone made it into a first-person shooter for all those gamers out there. Yay! Thanks for joining us! Hopefully that wasn't too painful.